Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Hello and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
I'm Katie Greifeld. I'm a cross-asset reporter at Bloomberg, and I'm filling in for Vildana Heyrich.
And this week on the show, well, there's a big disconnect going on right now. The job market is red hot, economic growth is strong, and the worst of the pandemic seems to be behind us. So why is one popular measure of consumer sentiment at the lowest in more than a decade? And what does it all mean for markets? We'll get into it with an expert on confidence and the role that confidence plays in decision-making. But first, Katie, excited to have you back on the show here. For all the Vildana fans out there, she's fine. She's just vacationing in Portugal. So I'm a little jealous, I got to say. And, you know, Katie,
she is so funny because 2 or 3 weeks ago, she was like complaining about this trip. She was like, I don't even want to go on it. I don't know if we should. I was like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, I picture her in Lisbon, like reading all the analyst notes on her phone and missing all the sites. and she was also like, you know, I started salivating when she told me she was going to Portugal there, because I thought back, I had a trip there a couple years ago and I must have gained 10 pounds. And I was like, Vildana, I had chorizo, the seafood's incredible. I had this incredible steak at this one place. And she's like, yeah, I don't eat fish or meat of any kind. And I was like, well, they have olives, I think. Maybe you could have some olives. I don't know.
You know, she loves cauliflower. I rest assured that she probably found some delicious cauliflower in Portugal. We'll can see. Only hope. But in any case, I look forward to the day when I next leave the country. Haven't been outside the borders in a while, but we should probably get to the guest, shouldn't we?
Yeah. Why don't you bring him in? I'm very excited about our guest, too. And not only because he's a blue hen like me, a professor at the University of Delaware, and at William & Mary, another fine school, but also because I feel like he covers some angles that we don't get into a lot on this show, and that's sort of behavioral finance and psychology and that sort of thing. And I'm also excited he's from my neck of the woods down in Chester County, Pennsylvania, beautiful corner of the world. So bring him in here, Katie.
All right. Well, if you were wondering what this man's name is, it is Peter Atwater. He is the president of Financial Insights, LLC. He's also a finance professor at William & Mary and the University of Delaware. I know I get the blue hen reference. It was a little lost on me, but here we are. But in any case, Peter, welcome to the show. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks, Katie and Mike. Glad to be here.
Peter, I wanted to start just sort of, if you could give us an idea of your approach. Like I said, you know, you sort of look a lot at more of the behavioral type of finance. And I think it's a really important time to talk about that, given this last few years have just been unlike anything we've ever seen before, I think, as far as investor psychology and the whole meme stock craze. Walk us through kind of your approach to how you think about these things.
Sure. So I look at things in terms of confidence. And when I think of confidence, I don't mean the theater of confidence, the self-confidence that so often gets discussed. I'm really talking about the feelings of certainty and control that we have in our lives, because those are the real factors in the choices we make. When we're confident, we think we know what's coming, and even more so, we think that we're capable of handling whatever that is. And we don't talk about it this way, but the opposite of confidence is vulnerability. When we feel like things are uncertain and we feel powerless, sort of like we felt and have been feeling a lot for the last 2 years. And so those feelings of vulnerability play into a lot of the choices that we make.
And so, Peter, I mean, it's interesting to hear you, you know, talk so much about confidence because, I mean, just recently we got consumer sentiment data that was just terrible. I mean, if you look at the consumer, they're still spending a lot of money, but looks like they're miserable about it. And I'm curious, you know, how you take inputs such as that, how you think about that in relation to confidence and how that feeds into markets.
Yeah, so I think in a couple of ways. One, I think we need to recognize that there is no single level of confidence, particularly today. And, you know, as the person who coined the term the K-shaped recovery, to me, there are two extremes to confidence. Those that are closest to the financial markets have one level that is distinct from those, particularly individuals who've worked throughout the pandemic out in the real world. And so I think what you're seeing is a lot of vulnerability being expressed in the consumer sentiment numbers. And vulnerability from any number of factors. It could be economic. It could be the fact that they're, you know, paying more at the pipe, at the pump, inflation, food prices. But what is also interesting is we see in a lot of these sentiment figures the impact of political vulnerability. And so when, you know, after the 2020 election, you could see where Republican economic confidence fell dramatically while Democrats' confidence improved. So I think we need to recognize that these measures are picking up much more than just how we feel about the economy. It's really how vulnerable or confident we feel more broadly.
And can we just talk about how good of a call that was, the K-shaped recovery? Could you explain just a little bit about that? As I remember, it's that, you know, the upper tiers, the upper income thresholds of society would recover from the pandemic more quickly, whereas the lower income sectors of, you know, society, they would have a harder time doing that.
And I bet, Peter, I bet you wish you could have trademarked that and gotten some royalties on that, because it was everywhere there for a while.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, it had nothing to do with economic factors. To me, those were going to follow. But I could immediately see in March of 2020, when those who worked in the service economy quickly pivoted to working from home. And the boost in confidence that that gave people relative to the doctors and the nurses and the folks who were, you know, taking care of the supermarket that didn't have that as a choice. And so you could see this real stark bifurcation in confidence that I felt that ultimately would play through into the economy, which is sort of what's happened.
Where do you suppose we are now in that recovery? I mean, has the upstroke and the downstroke of that K gotten close together? Are they getting further apart, do you think? What's sort of the status of it?
So I actually took the view that the real popularity of that term marked the extreme of it. You know, as somebody who watches narratives for a living, I've learned that correlations break down the moment everybody's talking about them. And I felt that this was just another one. And in many ways, we're starting to see that. You're seeing those at the bottom becoming much more strident about, you know, getting wage gains and pressing to unionize. You know, you're seeing a lot of activity where folks, you know, in the lower economic sphere are doing things to address the vulnerability that they're experiencing. And at the same time, you know, beginning a year ago, you could start to see sentiment decline within the financial markets themselves. And, you know, so I do think that the two lines are beginning to converge. The question in my mind is, ultimately, do those at the bottom, are they lifted, you know, far more than those at the top begin to feel vulnerable?
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Let's talk a little bit more about the financial markets and drill in there, because you sent us a ton of notes. They were extremely helpful, so thank you for that. And you said in one of your emails that, you know, you see a lady or the tiger potential to markets. And I would love to hear exactly what you mean by that.
The setup is this. We've had a year in which the most abstract, wild and crazy stocks have really suffered. And at the same time, we have sentiment, consumer sentiment that's really lousy. Consumer sentiment is so bad that you go back to October 2011, and what do you see? Well, you saw Occupy Wall Street. You saw riots in London. So we know that when sentiment is this low, we behave badly as people. Not surprising, you're seeing things like the trucker strike up in Canada. So we express our shared vulnerability in an active social way. And so part of me says, well, if this is like 2011, this is a low. This is a meaningful low that we should bounce from. And that's the lady scenario, the powder puff, as I call it, where you start, people start to feel better, inflation comes down, the bond market eases, equities rise. You could see popularity of Joe Biden begin to improve because presidents are only as good as we feel. So there are a lot of things that in this moment feel like they have the makings of a major sentiment low. That's challenged a little bit in terms of equity valuations. The valuations are nothing like they did in 2011, but okay, I'll live with that. The downside is the more troubling one to me, which is to say, if this isn't a low and sentiment really deteriorates, well, then you're getting into Lehman Brothers-like moments where trust, broad trust issues become a disconcerting factor to people. And so I think we need to be cognizant of those two potential scenarios. Not wishing for trouble, but I know that as somebody who focuses on confidence, if confidence really drops further, we're going to become much more aggressive about addressing the vulnerability we feel.
And Katie, this isn't a political statement, but Joe Biden, another blue hen. I don't know if you knew that.
Amazing.
There's
amazing.
A lot of us out there.
Well, it seems like a tough time for blue hens then. I don't know. It seems like the Biden administration is really worried about inflation. I mean, kind of to that point, I mean, to think about what could bring confidence lower. I mean, would it be inflation or what else do you have in mind?
So it could be inflation. I tend to think that things like gas prices become a really important test to consumer sentiment at this point. Same thing with food prices, the things that you can't control the quantity that you buy. So I do think that some of the basics could be factors. But, you know, don't forget, we have in the backdrop geopolitical risk in Europe. I tend to look less at the specific triggers than our vulnerability to them, how we would be likely to react. I mean, put it this way, you know, if you had said to the crowd that, you know, Tom Hanks getting COVID would create a collapse in sentiment, we'd all laugh. But that just happened to be the tipping point that coalesced the vulnerability that we were feeling. And so I think that's the kind of risk that we face here today.
But to me, Peter, it sounds like your base case is more sort of the lady of in the analogy, that we have kind of reached a bottom in sentiment and it's bound to perk up, and that, you know, a deterioration is more of a maybe not quite a tail risk, but not quite the base case. Does that sound right?
Well, I think broadly speaking, I think consumer sentiment is a low. But I think it's also important, Mike, to recognize how bifurcated that is. And so you could see those at the bottom begin to feel much better at the expense of those at the top. That would be reflected in higher overall consumer sentiment, just based on the numbers and how extraordinarily concentrated wealth is today. But you could see where confidence would rise and a situation where the markets are not happy about that, because it means that the pendulum has swung from owners of capital to employees of capital.
Right.
And in this conversation, I'm curious where you see the fixed income markets factoring in, because if I look at the yield on a 10-year treasury right now, I mean, give or take, it's around 2%, which we haven't seen in a while. You haven't really seen that overall haven bid for treasuries that, you know, one might expect to see listening to this conversation.
Yeah, and I think that's what's so weird about the past year. You know, one of the things that I noticed was that the same time you had meme stocks soaring, well, we had negative yielding sovereign debt soaring. And so you would say that's not a combination that I think goes hand in hand. You know, now there's those who would say, well, free money pumping the market, you know, but let's get away from those issues. I think that the broader question is, you know, what does it mean if we've seen bond prices and stock prices peak simultaneously? And there, I think that the 1970s are an interesting parallel, because you saw the end of a low interest rate environment simultaneous to a peaking in the equity market, and the consequences of rising bond yields and rising stock yields or stock prices or falling stock prices. One of the things that we also saw in that environment were concerns about systemic stability, you know, trust in the system, you know, whether it's Watergate or the dramatic changing of the guard at the Fed. You know, the question will be, how do investors interpret what this rise in rates signifies? Right now, it's pretty clear we're associating with it inflation. But it becomes a very different story if the signal means something different to the crowd.
I'm glad you brought up meme stocks, Peter. I know you've thought about them a lot, that whole phenomenon we saw. And I think it's especially interesting from your perspective as a university professor. You know, I just pictured all your students coming up to you like, you know, should I buy GameStop or Shiba Inu or what? It seems to me almost like nothing we've ever seen before, that mania. What was it like as a professor? I mean, was everyone trading on Robinhood in the middle of class? And what's kind of the climate there now? Is it all worn off? Has the fever broke? It seems like it has based on the prices, but.
Yeah, they were trading in class and they were trading, you know, initially the stocks, then they were moving into the options. You know, my head just about exploded when students came up to me and said, "Professor, I'm not making enough in call options. What do you think about futures?" And it's like, okay, I think we're, you know, it's pretty clear that everybody is in who's going to get in. And they were unconvincible that they were wrong, which is another behavioral trait that I always look for, is, you know, the inability to consider the other side. No, sentiment has clearly changed. You know, I think there is still a subsegment of the population that is fixated on the movement in cryptocurrencies and NFTs. But the mania stage is gone. And I think the moment Elon Musk, you know, walked onto the stage of Saturday Night Live, we sort of saw this simultaneous peaking in culture and finance that marked the top?
That was definitely the top of so many things in our society, so many things that we don't even know yet. But I am curious to hear a little bit more about your perspective as a professor, because something I wonder about, and I've talked about a little bit with various people, is that, you know, on the tail end of this roller coaster of meme mania coming down from those highs, you know, a lot of people probably lost a lot of money, probably a lot of people who were completely new to markets and new to investing. And I mean, the hope is that, you know, perhaps, I mean, the optimistic view is that perhaps they got involved in investing and trading with meme mania and they graduated on to maybe some more types of wealth building. You know, maybe hopefully they bought some index funds and put some cash there. But then the more pessimistic view was, you know, perhaps a lot of these people were burned and they've become a little bit disenchanted with the stock market, with investing. Would love to hear your perspective on that, especially someone who, you know, probably talks to a lot of people who did get involved during 2021.
Yeah, I think that the novice and naive are always the last of the party. And it's a pattern I look for, just in terms of broad measures of sentiment. I worry about the migration that we've seen, particularly among young people, is out of the stock market and into online gambling. That the gamification that we saw taking place in online stock trading platforms has moved to an environment that's even more familiar to young people, more resonant with young people. And you know, you just cannot talk to population of young people, particularly young men, without quickly getting swept up into what are you betting on, you know, this week in whatever the gamer event is.
Yeah, that's interesting. There is such an overlap, it seems like, you know, between the risk taking in the meme stocks and gambling. It's you can see people flipping between the same apps and every day, I would imagine.
And think back, I mean, to the start of it, and the whole reason that we were given for why we saw such a flood into Robinhood, right, and other apps was because there weren't any live sports that people were looking for an outlet.
No games to bet on. That's true.
Full circle.
Yeah. I mean, we've sort of merged Wall Street, Las Vegas, the metaverse, and social media into this phenomenon of betting on everything. And some of that, I think, you can attribute to sort of the pandemic nihilism that we've seen elsewhere. But to me, it's a really troubling intersection because of all of the iconic figures that have now been swept up into it, from sports figures to Hollywood figures to political figures. We've monetized celebrity to such an extreme that there's a lot more riding on this than just, you know, housing prices were in 2005. This is a big cultural phenomenon that transcends the markets and cuts across all of America in many ways I don't think we yet understand.
You know, Peter, one thing I wanted to unpack a little bit, you had a great point in your email to us before the show about how you're watching gold. I just want to read a little bit of your email because I thought it was a good line. You said, even with the recent rally in commodities, few have found a reason to buy precious metals. It's the Buick in a sea of EVs, which I tip my hat. That's a good line. But I wonder what's going on there. I mean, obviously, crypto has been pitched as sort of digital gold. It's debatable whether it plays the same sort of role as gold would in a portfolio, but I do think a lot of people are subscribing to that idea. Is that part of what's going on with gold, do you think, or is it something else?
Yeah, and just to be clear to listeners, I am not a gold bug. I am not a, you know, I'm a pretty agnostic observer of things. And what's been so startling to me is that you look at the commodity space. And you know, from lumber to oil to iron ore to you name it, those commodity prices have exploded. So this is a product, an investment that has been left out of every mania we've seen in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. And we can attribute it to it's old, it's stodgy, it's the antithesis of cool. And until it reacts, people don't know what to make of it. And it's been a fascinating thing to watch because we've had this enormous multi-year coil in gold. You know, I don't know if it will resolve up or down, but what I've learned behaviorally is coils are like an enormous tug of war where energy is expended in vast amounts between the bulls and the bears until one side finally lets loose. And so, as I said, I don't know which direction it's going to be, but gold is going to give us some signs as to what is happening as far as sentiment.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Peter, I wanted to quickly also go back to, you know, a point you made that this could be like the 1970s and we might see, you know, stock and bond prices peak at the same time. And I have to admit, I wasn't close to alive in the 1970s. So I'd love to hear, you know, where was the hiding place then? What was the haven asset then?
So the haven asset was gold. The haven asset were real assets. And I think that's, you know, real assets, I think of as a counterpoint to all of the abstraction that we have so eagerly embraced in this cycle. And that abstraction is in many ways a mirror of the kinds of abstractions we saw in the 1960s. You know, we've got space again, we've got, you know, in this case, it's social media, not television, and you know, the internet, not, you know, telephone. But there's a clear series of behavioral parallels leading up to what's happening now that we saw in the 1960s. And you know, again, not surprising to see the same kinds of social tensions, political tensions playing out now, because we're feeling the same way from a confidence perspective.
Right. Katie, I'm glad you brought up space. That's a good teaser for my craziest thing of the week. But we're not there yet, because I do want to rewind a little bit, Peter, and ask you to elaborate on a little something you just mentioned about sort of this uneasiness, especially the political nature of confidence. You know, you mentioned the Republican confidence sank, Democratic confidence went higher after the election. And that's not, you know, I've looked at the University of Michigan partisan confidence indexes. It's not an unusual thing for that to happen, but the extent that it happened, I think, is off the charts, like nothing we've ever seen. And, you know, all of a sudden you see protesters from the right side of the aisle, you know, January 6th and the truckers protest in Canada, you know, something new that I've never remember anything like this in my lifetime. You know, I don't I don't remember anyone hitting the streets after Bill Clinton was elected or anything like that. But I'm curious what you think. Two things. What do you think's driving that? I mean, to me, as from my perspective in the media, it seems like this really bifurcated media atmosphere we have with, you know, right wing news and left wing news, and really seems to be, you know, getting further and further apart. And secondly, I like, how does this resolve itself in markets? Is it at play as a sort of driver of anything in markets, do you think, or is it just a sideshow?
So a couple of things. You know, the way I think of politics and confidence relates to a broader thought, which is, when I don't have confidence, the only thing I care about is me here now. You know, if I'm vulnerable, if I'm under attack, I don't care about you or anywhere else or any time in the future. On the other hand, when I'm really confident, it's about us. It's about, you know, a broad, you know, expansive world and well into the future. We can afford to be generous. And so what we've seen is an environment of extraordinary political generosity in the United States, in Europe, you know, the coming together of the Eurozone, you know, Bill Clinton being all but indistinguishable from, you know, George H.W. Bush. I mean, we had an environment of us everywhere, forever politics. And there's a great Time magazine cover, you know, from a couple of years ago, you know, the center, the place to be, which is hard to imagine today. And as confidence falls, we naturally come apart. We balkanize. We become about the people that are most familiar to me, that feel the same way that I do, you know, the isming of the population. And I think that's one of the things that confuses people, is we want to be very clear that it's left versus right or up versus down. And that's not how we schism. It's never a clean break like that. And it becomes more of a my enemy's my enemy sort of a mindset. And so if I think about politics in its current version, which, you know, we would think of as left versus right, a more capitalist versus a more socialist market environment. And I think that we could see things play out that way. I'm more interested, not left and right, but how to up and down resolve. Because that to me is where the greatest difference is in American culture today. You know, there's a lot that potentially could unify and coalesce those at the bottom that is underappreciated today, that would make those at the top feel far more vulnerable. I tend to look at, where do we see small groups coming together? Because what's likely to happen is you'll see these big Goliaths being upended by small grassroots groups that resonate. We saw that 18 months ago with the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, there was no centralized figure, but there was this spontaneous feeling of shared voicelessness and vulnerability that all of a sudden spread across, you know, city after city.
And I mean, while we're on the subject of politics, I feel like we have to mention the fact that, you know, you do have midterm elections coming up somehow. You know, a lot of predictions are for a divided Congress coming out of those elections. What do you think that would do to, you know, confidence and sentiment and the markets largely?
So I think election outcomes are a reflection of it rather than a contributor to it. So what we tend to find is that it's the mood going into the polls that matters, not the mood coming out of the polls. So I tend to think that a lot of what we think of as being causal conditions are really consequences of how we felt leading up to them. For example, you know, we think of 9/11 as causing American confidence to fall. Well, if you look at the confidence across the Middle East in that moment, it becomes pretty clear that that would be a contributor to terrorist attacks. You know, the food inflation contributing to the Arab Spring, you know, a couple of years later. So I tend to look at a lot of social behavior as a consequence of the feelings that then just gets reported on a tally board. So if we see confidence rise between now and November, you should expect incumbents and you know, those on the left doing better. If confidence were to fall, then that's an environment where we are, where the view oust the incumbents, get rid of the people in office. You know, we vote people out when confidence is low. We don't care who we vote in. It's the action of destruction and elimination that we become fixated on.
That's when we should get ready for truckers to show up in the Holland Tunnel or something, or in, you know, in the Beltway around D.C.
Yeah, and social protest is a great indicator of where mood is going. Whether it's, you know, the yellow vests in France or the Arab Spring or the trucker strike in Canada today.
Fascinating stuff, Peter. You know, Katie, as the father of a prospective college student, I got to tell you, normally you have to spend a fortune for insights like this from a good professor like this. So we appreciated the tuition-free download from Peter this week. Really interesting.
Hopefully a lot of college students are listening to this podcast right now.
Yeah, they got a free one.
Tighten up your straitjackets. It's time for the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Before we let him go, we have to continue on with our tradition of the craziest things we saw this week. Katie, I always have high hopes for you. I know you come with something good for the craziest thing. You're grimacing there a little bit. You might be underprepared this week. I don't know. Vildana will let you know. We'll let you hear about it if you do not deliver.
I know. Well, I do feel like I'm flying a little bit by the seat of my pants when it comes to the crazy thing this market. But I'm going to go straight to a story from Joe Weisenthal. The headline says it all. Hilton has now nearly outperformed Zoom video since the pandemic hit. Both of those stocks are up about 140% since the depths of March 2020, which I just think is a really neat encapsulation of, you know, all of the steam that has come out of some of these pandemic favorites. I mean, you saw that with Shopify and Roblox earnings just this week.
Does that signal anything to you, Peter? Are people gaining confidence that this pandemic's the worst is behind us?
Well, you know, for a long time, I've been using Carnival Cruise Lines as my Main Street sentiment indicator. And, you know, that one still leaves me thinking that we're still unresolved, that there's a coil of tension between, you know, can we believe this to be true, that the worst is behind us? Or do we still feel like we have one foot on a banana peel?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, that talk about ground zero of the COVID in the market, that's it. That's pretty good. All right, good one to watch. Yeah, I forgot about them. How about you, Peter? You see anything crazy this week? I know that's a silly question. We probably should switch it. Have you seen anything rational this week? But what's what's the craziest thing you saw?
So one of the things that's really caught my attention, and this is the former bank treasurer in me who's always interested in mismatches, is the private equity fascination now with overnight rental. You know, whether it's buying homes or vacation properties, and we've gone from, you know, buying homes to buying homes for long-term rentals to short-term rentals to now overnight. And I struggle with that just because, you know, the liquidity difference, the mismatch, if we see any sort of deflation, it just boggles my mind at our willingness to ignore long-term assets that we're pricing overnight. It's basically funding a bank with commercial paper in my books, which you just never do.
Right. I forgot about your banker days. You were Bank One, right?
Bank One, JP Morgan, a long time.
Yeah, before the roll-up. Interesting. Well, that's a banker's instinct is probably a good way to a good thing to keep in mind whenever looking at the market. So that's a smart way to do it. All right, I'm going to give you my craziest thing. As I teased it, it is space related, Katie. And this is courtesy of stories both Bloomberg, Forbes, probably some others had it. But apparently, among the cryptocurrency millionaires out there, another asset class has become very popular to spend your crypto millions on, and that is meteorites. So Christie's recently had a meteorite auction, several meteorites and meteorite-related items, including, and this is the craziest one, a doghouse that was hit by a meteorite and the meteorite went right through the roof of it, almost killed the German Shepherd named Roki, who's sleeping inside of it.
Wow.
Yeah. As regular listeners will know, it's time to play Price is Right on what Christie's expects this meteorite hit doghouse will sell for at auction. And I will tell you, it's nothing to brag about, this doghouse. I saw a picture of it. It was basically made out of old shipping pallets and like corrugated sheet metal. But obviously, pretty sturdy doghouse. I mean, it survived a meteorite strike.
Does it come with an NFT?
It's not yet an NFT. I'm sure it will be soon. What do you think Christie's expected price, sales price? And it's a range, so you can give me a range. I don't know if this helps, but the actual meteorite that went through the roof of it is only expected to go for $60,000. But the doghouse is the real star of the auction, so I'm maybe giving away too much information here. Katie, what's your bid on a doghouse with a hole in the roof from a meteorite? Keeping in mind that, and I'll give you a great quote from the Forbes story on it. A person at Christie said, last year, a lot of people were cashing out crypto and going into meteorites. So it's a hot asset class right now among the laser-eyed set out there.
Okay. So, I mean, I have to knock a couple hundred thousand off because it's a physical object and it's not an NFT.
That's true. NFT form would probably double or triple it for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. You said it's a range. I'm going to say $800,000 to $1 million.
All right. I'm keeping my poker face. Peter, what's your bid on this doghouse? Price is Right rules are in effect. So take that for what it's worth.
So I'm going to go $500 to $750. I'm going to go the low end. You know, today, anything's possible.
I will say, Christie's would love to have both of you in the audience of this auction. They're estimating 200 to 300,000. I could see it going for more, though. I think we'll have to check back on this. I think one of you guys could be in the right ballpark.
That's a value stock. you should be able to get much more for that.
But the problem is you let your dog sleep in there and it's got a hole in the roof. He's going to get rained on. So I don't know. It's but... With that said, that is the craziest thing I saw this week. And I think that's all we have time for. But Peter, great to catch up with you. Fascinating conversation. And I hope we can have you back someday. And Katie, you know, I'll always be coming to you when Vildana is off gallivanting around the world.
Whenever she wants to go to Portugal, I'm right here.
Eating cauliflower on all the world's continents.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Katie.
Thanks so much, guys. Thanks, Peter. What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Katie Greifeld is at K Greifeld. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pellet of Bloomberg Radio. What Goes Up is produced by Laura Carlson. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.